A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's back with a follow-up to our episode on disaster food supplies. He wants to know about the medicine side of that same problem. The World Health Organization keeps a list of what it calls essential medicines. Not the flashiest drugs, not the cutting edge. The skeleton. His questions are straightforward. How was that list put together in the first place? How often does it change? And when does it actually matter?
The answer to that last question is where the list gets interesting, because most people hear essential medicines and picture a field hospital after an earthquake. That's not wrong, but it's maybe 20% of the story.
So, what's the other 80%?
National procurement, insurance reimbursement, the boring plumbing of health systems. Over 150 countries use the WHO list as the starting point for what their public clinics will stock, what their national insurance will pay for, what gets imported duty-free. When a medicine lands on that list, it becomes a purchasing decision for a finance ministry somewhere.
So it's less a survival kit and more a shopping list for governments.
That's the better framing. And the survival kit part is real, but it's downstream. The emergency health kits, the cholera kits, the trauma backpacks, those are built on top of the essential medicines list. They're separate catalogs. The list itself is about routine health systems.
Let's go back to the beginning then. Because I want to understand how 8 people in a room in Geneva decided what counts as essential for the entire planet.
It's worse than 8 people in a room. It was 8 people in a room for 5 days. October 1977. The first expert committee on the selection of essential drugs met from the 17th to the 21st. 5 days to produce a list of about 220 medicines.
5 days for the foundational document of global pharmaceutical policy.
And the report was 36 pages, a small blue booklet. It sold out in 3 months, which for a WHO technical report is basically Harry Potter.
Who were the 8?
Mostly pharmacologists and clinical pharmacologists from Brazil, France, Italy, and the United States. 2 from developing countries, 1 from Indonesia, 1 from Sri Lanka. No one from Africa on the original panel. They had to recruit a Ghanaian physician from the Ministry of Health specifically to fill that gap.
No women either, I'm guessing.
No women. And the pharmaceutical industry wasn't invited until the second committee in 1979.
So the industry that makes the medicines had no say in the first version of the list that would shape their market for the next 50 years.
Deliberately. And here's the detail I find most telling. The committee refused to publish justifications for why any given drug was included or excluded. They were explicit about it. One of the people involved later wrote that they felt publishing justifications would have led to endless discussions after the report came out, particularly with the pharmaceutical industry.
So they made the calls and didn't show their work.
Which is wild by today's standards. The current process publishes every application, every review, everything out for public comment. Anyone can submit a proposal to add a medicine. Researchers, patient groups, pharmaceutical companies, non-governmental organizations. It's completely open now.
But in 1977, they were basically a secret committee, deciding the fate of global drug markets.
A secret committee that produced a bestseller. The thing is, the trigger wasn't a disaster. It was a 1975 speech by the WHO Director General at the time, Halfdan Mahler. He stood up at the World Health Assembly and said there was an urgent need to ensure that most essential drugs are available. That produced a resolution, and a small unit of 3 people started preparing the list.
3 people?
The Drug Policies and Management Unit. The chief was Hiroshi Nakajima, who later became Director General himself. They did the preparatory work, then an October 1976 consultation produced an annotated list of about 200 active substances. That was the draft the 1977 committee worked from.
What was the actual problem they were trying to solve? Because essential medicines sounds like a nice idea, but there had to be a specific failure.
The therapeutic jungle. That's the phrase from the period. By the mid-70s, the pharmaceutical industry had produced thousands of products, but the innovation wasn't tracking public health needs. Developing countries were spending 20 to 60% of their health budgets on medicines, with up to 90% of that paid out of pocket. And they were buying whatever the market pushed at them, not what their populations actually needed.
So the list was a market correction.
A rationing tool, honestly. The original insight was that some medicines are more important than others. That sounds obvious now, but in 1977 it was a genuine revolution in public health thinking. The idea that you could draw a line around a few hundred drugs and say, these are the ones that matter, everything else is optional.
And the criteria?
Disease prevalence, public health relevance, evidence of efficacy and safety, and comparative cost effectiveness. Those are still the criteria today. The second committee in 1985 spelled out the practical considerations. What diseases are actually prevalent? What treatment facilities exist? What training the available personnel have? What financial resources are there? And local genetic, demographic, and environmental factors.
So it was never just about the drugs themselves. It was about whether the system could actually deliver them.
A medicine that requires refrigeration and a specialist to administer isn't essential for a rural clinic with no electricity and a nurse with 6 months of training. That's why you see older, simpler drugs on the list sometimes instead of newer, better ones. The question isn't what works in a Boston teaching hospital. It's what works in a district hospital in rural Zambia with intermittent power and one pharmacist.
Which is probably why the list has a reputation for being conservative.
And that reputation is partly earned, partly outdated. The list today has 523 medicines for adults, 374 for children. That's a lot of drugs. The 2007 edition had 340. It's grown substantially.
How often does it actually get updated?
Every 2 years, like clockwork since 1977. The current version is the 24th edition, released in September 2025. The expert committee meets for a week in Geneva, reviews applications, makes decisions, and the new list comes out.
And the children's list?
That's separate. The first essential medicines list for children appeared in 2007. It's now on its 10th edition. There are some striking differences from the adult list. The children's list currently excludes all medicines for mental and behavioral disorders for children under 13. They removed the entire section in 2023.
Wait, no mental health medicines for children at all?
Nothing. No ADHD medications, no antidepressants, nothing in that category for children under 13. The adult list has a full mental health section. The children's list just has a gap where section 24 used to be.
That seems like a pretty glaring hole for a list that's supposed to cover priority health needs.
It's controversial. The committee has declined to add methylphenidate for ADHD, citing long-term safety concerns. They rejected brexpiprazole as an add-on for major depression because the incremental benefit was modest. The position seems to be that the evidence base for psychiatric medication in young children isn't strong enough to justify listing.
But untreated childhood mental illness is a priority health need in plenty of countries.
That's the tension. The list is supposed to be evidence-driven, and if the evidence is thin, the committee won't list the drug. But the absence from the list has real consequences. Countries building their national formularies look at the WHO list and say, okay, no psychiatric medicines for children, we won't stock them either.
So the gap propagates.
That's the power of the list. It's a model, not a mandate. WHO is very careful to say that exactly which medicines are regarded as essential remains a national responsibility. But when you're a small country with limited regulatory capacity, the model list is the default. You don't have the resources to do your own independent assessment of every drug, so you adopt the WHO list and adjust at the margins.
Which means the committee's decisions in Geneva have outsized influence on what medicines are available to billions of people.
That's the whole ballgame, and the committee knows it, which is why the process has become more transparent over time. In 1977, they hid their reasoning to avoid fights. Today, every application is public, every review is public, and the committee publishes detailed reports explaining their decisions.
Let's talk about the 2025 update, because that's the current one, and I know there was a big decision about the diabetes drugs.
The GLP-1 agonists, semaglutide, dulaglutide, liraglutide, all added, plus tirzepatide, which is the dual GLP-1 and GIP agonist. These are the drugs everyone's been talking about for weight loss. The committee added them for type 2 diabetes with cardiovascular disease or chronic kidney disease, and for obesity with a BMI over 30.
But they rejected semaglutide as a standalone obesity treatment.
Correct. The diabetes indication with cardiovascular or kidney complications got in. The pure obesity indication did not, and the committee explicitly warned that high prices are limiting access to these drugs.
Which is the recurring theme. Being on the list doesn't mean being obtainable.
That's the thing about the 2002 shift. Before 2002, affordability was a precondition for listing. If a drug was too expensive, it didn't get on the list, period. That meant the list was realistic, but also conservative. It excluded expensive drugs that were essential.
So they changed the rule.
They flipped it. Affordability went from being a precondition to being a consequence. A cost-effective but expensive medicine can now be listed, with the implication that listing creates pressure to make it affordable. The first example was first-line antiretrovirals for HIV. Added in 2002 at over $1,000 per patient per year. By 2007, they cost under $100.
The list became a price negotiation lever.
That's the strategic genius of it. You put the drug on the list, you signal to every country that this is essential, and then the generic manufacturers, the procurement agencies, the international funders all align around it. The price comes down because the demand is consolidated.
So the list is doing market shaping, not just rationing.
Both at once. It rations attention. It says to the world, these 523 medicines are the ones that matter for adults. Focus your procurement, your regulation, your generic manufacturing on these. And at the same time, it creates a floor of demand that makes it worth a generic manufacturer's while to produce the drug.
The 2025 update also added some cancer drugs, right?
Pembrolizumab for metastatic cervical, colorectal, and non-small cell lung cancer, with atezolizumab and simiplimab as alternatives. These are checkpoint inhibitors, immunotherapy drugs, very expensive. The committee has a rule that cancer medicines must prolong life by at least 4 to 6 months to be listed.
4 to 6 months is the bar.
That's the threshold. And even with that bar, very few cancer drugs make the list. Cancer medicines are about half of all new regulatory approvals, but only a handful are on the essential medicines list. The committee is extremely selective.
Because most new cancer drugs extend life by weeks, not months, and cost a fortune.
And the committee is asking a different question than a regulator. A drug regulator asks, is this safe and does it work? The Essential Medicines Committee asks, does this work well enough to justify displacing something else from the list? It's a zero-sum game. Adding a drug means a country's procurement budget has to stretch further.
The cystic fibrosis drug got in too, didn't it?
Tligafta. The elexacaftor, tezacaftor, ivacaftor combination. That's a genuine breakthrough for cystic fibrosis, and it's on the list now. Also cytosine for nicotine addiction, which is interesting because cytosine is an old, cheap drug that's been used in Eastern Europe for decades. It's dramatically cheaper than varenicline or nicotine replacement.
So the list isn't all expensive new biologics. Sometimes it's an old Soviet bloc drug that got overlooked.
And that's the beauty of the process. The committee isn't chasing novelty. They're asking what works, what's cost-effective, what can actually be delivered. Cytosine is a perfect essential medicine. It's cheap, it's effective, it's been used for decades, and it was invisible to most of the world because it was developed and marketed in a different system.
Let's get to the emergency angle, because that's what Daniel was actually asking about. The skeleton framework for emergency medicine.
The Interagency Emergency Health Kit. That's the flagship. The 2024 version is designed to provide medicines and equipment for 10,000 people for 3 months. It's structured as 10 basic modules, each covering 1,000 people plus one supplementary module.
10,000 people for 3 months. That's a very specific number.
It's designed to be deployed in the first phase of an emergency, before the regular supply chain is reestablished. The kit is held in stock by major generic suppliers, most of whom can ship within 48 hours of an order.
So the kit is sitting in warehouses right now, waiting.
In multiple locations around the world. UN agencies, non-governmental organizations, national governments all use it. When a refugee crisis erupts or an earthquake flattens a region, the kit is what gets loaded onto trucks and planes in the first days.
And the contents are based on the essential medicines list.
Primarily. The kit contents are derived from the essential medicines list plus WHO treatment guidelines for specific conditions. But the kit is a separate catalog. Its purpose, built for emergencies, not just a subset of the list. There are also specific kits for cholera, pneumonia, measles, major trauma, non-communicable diseases, and transfusion.
So the essential medicines list is the foundation, and the emergency kits are the application.
That's the precise relationship. Daniel's framing was directionally right. The list is the skeleton. The emergency kits are the skeleton with muscles and skin attached, optimized for a specific scenario.
What about refugee settings? UNHCR has its own list, doesn't it?
UNHCR maintains its own essential medicines and medical supplies list, developed after cross-referencing the WHO model list. It's tailored to refugee camp settings where you have a captive population with specific disease patterns and limited infrastructure.
So there's a whole ecosystem of lists built on top of the WHO list.
National lists, emergency kits, refugee lists, disease-specific kits. The WHO list is the trunk, and all these other things are branches.
Let's talk about the actual numbers on access, because I think that's where the rubber meets the road.
About 2 billion people lack regular access to essential medicines. That's the estimate from WHO. And in low and lower middle-income countries, the Global Health Observatory found that only 8 to 41% of health facilities had a core set of essential medicines available and affordable.
8%. That's the low end.
8% of facilities in some countries have the core medicines available and affordable. So you have a list that's been carefully curated for 50 years, and in the poorest places, fewer than 1 in 10 health facilities can actually stock the basics.
That's the gap between the list and the reality.
And it's not a knowledge problem. The list is well known. The problem is financing, supply chains, regulatory capacity, corruption, all the unglamorous stuff. The list is necessary but not sufficient.
Which is probably why WHO keeps emphasizing that the list is a tool, not a solution.
The 2025 announcement quoted their director of policy and standards saying that achieving equitable access requires a coherent health system response backed by strong political will. That's WHO speak for, the list alone doesn't fix anything.
Let me ask you something about the selection process itself. The committee reviews 59 applications in a week. That's a lot of decisions in a short time.
The 2025 committee reviewed 59 applications, including 31 proposals for new medicines or classes. Added 20 to the adult list, 15 to the children's list. The committee meets for 5 days. That's the same length as the first meeting in 1977.
5 days to decide what billions of people will have access to.
The committee members do enormous preparatory work before the meeting. They read the applications, review the evidence, consult with experts. The week in Geneva is for deliberation and decision, not for doing the homework.
Still, it's a remarkable concentration of decision-making power.
It is, and the committee isn't elected. It's appointed by WHO. The members are experts in clinical pharmacology, public health, evidence-based medicine. They're supposed to be independent, not representing their countries or any commercial interest.
But they're mostly from wealthy countries, I assume.
The membership has diversified since 1977. There are now members from all WHO regions. But the expertise tends to cluster in academic institutions that are concentrated in high-income countries. That's a structural problem, not a conspiracy.
It's the same problem as the first committee. The people with the credentials to evaluate medicines tend to be trained in the places where the medicines are developed.
And the perspective matters. A clinical pharmacologist at a European university may not fully appreciate what it means to stock a medicine in a clinic with no reliable cold chain. That's why the committee also includes people with field experience in low-resource settings.
Let's talk about what the list actually looks like. 523 medicines. How is it organized?
By therapeutic category. Anesthetics, analgesics, anti-infectives, cardiovascular medicines, dermatologicals, and so on. Each medicine is listed by its international non-proprietary name, not by brand name.
So it's generic names only.
The list doesn't care who makes the drug. It cares what the active ingredient is. That's part of why it works as a market-shaping tool. It's brand agnostic by design.
and the medicines on the list are supposed to be available at all times, in adequate amounts, in the appropriate dosage forms, at a price the individual and the community can afford.
That's the WHO definition of access. It's not just about the list existing. It's about the medicines being physically present, affordable, and of assured quality.
Quality is a big issue in low-income countries, isn't it? Substandard and falsified medicines.
Huge issue. The list doesn't solve that problem directly, but it helps by concentrating procurement on a defined set of medicines. When you're buying 500 medicines instead of 5,000, you can focus your quality assurance resources.
So the list is also a regulatory simplification tool.
That's a good way to think about it. A country with limited regulatory capacity can't meaningfully oversee 5,000 different medicines, but it can oversee 500. The list makes the problem tractable.
What's the most surprising thing on the current list? Something a listener wouldn't expect.
Oxygen is on the list. Medical oxygen as a medicine. It's listed as an essential medicine for the treatment of hypoxemia. That was reinforced during the pandemic, when oxygen shortages killed people in low-income countries.
Oxygen as a medicine. That's a good example of the list thinking beyond pills.
The list includes vaccines, diagnostics, and medical devices. It's not just pharmaceuticals. The full package is about what a health system needs to deliver priority care.
And what's the most surprising thing that's not on the list?
For me, it's the children's mental health gap. That's the most glaring omission. But there are also drugs that are widely used in wealthy countries that have never made the list because they fail the cost-effectiveness test.
Likewise.
A lot of the newer biologics for autoimmune diseases. They're effective, but the price is so high that the committee judges them not cost-effective for the global context. The list isn't a list of everything that works. It's a list of everything that works well enough to justify its cost.
Which is a very different proposition.
And that's the part most people don't understand about the list. It's not a best of list, it's a best value list. The committee is making economic judgments, not just clinical ones.
So when a new cancer drug gets rejected, it's not because the committee thinks it doesn't work. It's because the committee thinks the cost per month of life gained is too high.
The 4 to 6 month survival threshold is a cost-effectiveness proxy. If a drug extends life by 6 weeks at a cost of $100,000, it's not going to make the list, no matter how innovative it is.
Let's go back to the emergency kits for a minute, because that's the part that feels most concrete. The Interagency Emergency Health Kit. 10,000 people for 3 months. What's actually in it?
The basic modules contain medicines for the most common conditions in emergency settings. Antibiotics, analgesics, antiparasitics, oral rehydration salts, basic cardiovascular medicines, medicines for respiratory infections, skin conditions, eye infections, plus basic medical equipment, syringes, needles, sutures, dressings, basic diagnostic tools.
So it's a field hospital in boxes.
It's a primary care system in boxes. It's not designed for surgery or intensive care. It's designed to keep 10,000 people alive for 3 months while the regular health system is rebuilt or reestablished.
And the supplementary module?
That's for a more advanced level of care. Additional medicines and equipment that a district hospital might need. It's optional depending on the setting.
The 48-hour shipping window is remarkable. That means the kits are pre-positioned and ready to go.
That's the whole point. In an emergency, you don't have time to procure medicines through normal channels. The kit is the buffer stock. It's the difference between having antibiotics on day 3 and having them on day 30.
Which is the difference between life and death in a cholera outbreak?
Cholera can kill in hours without treatment. The cholera kit is separate from the general emergency kit, and it's designed to be deployed even faster.
So the system has layers. The essential medicines list is the foundation. The emergency kits are the rapid response layer. The national lists are the routine layer.
And the disease-specific kits are the specialized layer. It's a coherent architecture, even if the implementation is patchy.
The 1977 list had about 220 medicines. The current list has 523. That's growth, but not explosive growth. Over 50 years, the list has roughly doubled.
Which is actually remarkable restraint, given how many new medicines have been developed in that period. The committee has added an average of about 6 medicines per year. That's a very conservative rate of expansion.
So the list has stayed true to its original purpose. It's still a small proportion of all available medicines.
WHO explicitly says that essential medicines represent only a small proportion of the total number of medicines available globally. The point is selectivity. The list is valuable precisely because it excludes most things.
There's something almost philosophical about that. The idea that in medicine, as in food, as in disaster supplies, the most important skill is knowing what to leave out.
And that's the connection to Daniel's food episode. The same logic applies. In a crisis, you don't need the full supermarket. You need the foods that keep people alive. The essential medicines list is the same exercise for drugs.
The difference is that the food list was about calories and nutrients. The medicine list is about disease burden and cost-effectiveness.
But the underlying principle is identical. Prioritization under scarcity. You can't stock everything, so you have to decide what matters most.
Let's talk about the 2025 editions one more time, because the GLP-1 decision is interesting. These are expensive drugs. Semaglutide costs over $1,000 a month in the United States.
And the committee added them anyway. That's the 2002 logic in action. The committee is saying these drugs are essential for a specific population and the price needs to come down to make them accessible.
But the price hasn't come down yet.
Not meaningfully. The committee acknowledged that high prices are limiting access. The listing creates pressure, but it doesn't guarantee affordability. The ARV story took 5 years to play out. The GLP-1 story is just beginning.
And the obesity indication was rejected, which is interesting because obesity affects over 1 billion people globally.
The committee's reasoning seems to be that the evidence for obesity treatment is still evolving, and the cost-effectiveness case isn't yet clear. For diabetes with cardiovascular or kidney complications, the case is stronger. The drugs prevent heart attacks and kidney failure, which are expensive to treat.
So it's not just about the drug's effect on the primary condition. It's about the downstream savings.
That's cost-effectiveness analysis. You look at the total system cost, not just the drug price. If a drug prevents expensive complications, it can be cost-effective even at a high price.
Which is why the committee needs economists, not just clinicians.
The committee includes health economists and public health specialists. It's a multidisciplinary exercise.
Let's talk about the transparency shift one more time, because I think it's one of the most interesting parts of the story. In 1977, the committee hid its reasoning to avoid fights. Today, everything is public.
And the fights happen anyway. The pharmaceutical industry lobbies hard for its products to be listed. Patient groups advocate for their diseases to be prioritized. The public comment periods are contested.
But the transparency means the fights happen in the open, with evidence on the table.
That's the theory. In practice, the evidence is often contested. Different stakeholders interpret the same data differently. The committee has to make a judgment call.
And that judgment call has consequences for billions of people.
Which is why the committee's independence matters so much. If the process were captured by commercial interests, the list would lose its credibility. And without credibility, it'd lose its influence.
So the list's power comes from its reputation for being evidence-driven and independent.
That's the whole game. The list has no enforcement power. WHO can't force any country to adopt it. Its influence comes entirely from its perceived legitimacy.
And that legitimacy was built over 50 years of careful, conservative, evidence-based decisions.
With some notable exceptions. The 1977 process wasn't transparent, the committee wasn't representative, the list has evolved, and the process has improved. But the legitimacy is real, and it's earned.
Let's talk about what the list means for a specific country. Say a small country in sub-Saharan Africa is building its national formulary. What does the process look like?
They start with the WHO list as the baseline, then they adjust for local disease patterns. If malaria is endemic, they add more antimalarials. If HIV prevalence is high, they prioritize antiretrovirals. They consider their health system capacity. What can their clinics actually deliver? What can their budget afford?
So it's the WHO list plus local adaptation.
That's the ideal. In practice, many countries adopt the WHO list with minimal changes because they lack the capacity for independent assessment. That's why the WHO list matters so much. It's the default for countries that can't do their own homework.
And the national list then determines what's available in public clinics, what's covered by national insurance, what gets imported.
The national list is the operational document. The WHO list is the template. The connection between them is direct and consequential.
In 1977, only about a dozen countries had national essential medicines lists. Today, over 150 do.
4 out of 5 countries. That's the measure of the list's success. It's become the global standard.
But the access gap remains. 2 billion people without regular access.
The list solved the intellectual problem. It didn't solve the political and economic problems. Those are harder.
Which is probably the honest conclusion. The list is a necessary tool, not a sufficient one.
And that's true of most global health interventions. The technical solution is the easy part. The implementation is where it gets hard.
Daniel's question about when the list becomes relevant. I think the answer is, it becomes relevant every time a government decides what medicines to buy, every time an aid agency decides what to stock, every time an emergency kit is assembled. It's the invisible infrastructure of global pharmaceutical access.
And it's been doing that work for 50 years, mostly unnoticed. The list is one of those things that only becomes visible when it fails. When a medicine is missing from a clinic, when an emergency kit doesn't have what's needed, that's when people notice the list exists.
The absence is the evidence.
The absence is the evidence. And the list is the attempt to make the absence smaller.
59 applications.
That's the number the committee reviewed.
In 1986, I worked in a pharmacy warehouse in Rotterdam. We stocked 4,000 different medicines. The pharmacist would walk the aisles with a clipboard and decide what to reorder based on what it sold. Nobody ever asked whether the 4,000 were the right 4,000.
That's the difference between a market-driven system and a needs-driven system.
The WHO list is a needs-driven system. It starts from the diseases and works backward to the medicines. A warehouse starts from the medicines and works backward to the sales.
The two systems produce very different outcomes.
The warehouse in Rotterdam had 8 different brands of the same blood pressure medicine, all the same molecule, different boxes, different prices. The pharmacist stocked all 8 because different doctors prescribed different brands. Nobody was coordinating.
That's the therapeutic jungle the WHO list was designed to cut through.
The list says, here's the molecule, here's the dose, this is what matters. The brand is irrelevant. That's the part I always thought was the real innovation, not the selection, the standardization.
The list is a coordination mechanism.
It tells everyone what to focus on. The generic manufacturers know what to produce. The procurement agencies know what to buy. The clinics know what to stock. The trainers know what to teach. Without the list, everyone's guessing.
The guessing is expensive. Money wasted on duplicate brands, on medicines that don't match the disease burden, on products that expire before they're used.
We used to throw away pallets of expired medicines in Rotterdam, not because they were bad medicines, because they were the wrong medicines, ordered on a hunch, or because a sales rep made a good pitch.
The list is waste reduction as much as anything else.
That's what I'd call it. A way to stop buying things you don't need so you can afford the things you do.
In a country spending 60% of its health budget on medicines, that waste is the difference between treating patients and not treating them.
The warehouse in Rotterdam could afford the waste. A clinic in rural Malawi can't. The list is for the clinic in Malawi.
Did you ever see the emergency kits in your warehouse days?
Once. A shipment came through for an NGO heading to a refugee camp. Boxes and boxes. All the same size, all numbered. I asked what was in them. The foreman said, everything you need to keep 10,000 people alive for 3 months.
That's the Interagency Emergency Health Kit.
I remember thinking, that's a very specific number. 10,000 people. 3 months. Somebody sat down and figured out exactly what that requires. Every box, every vial, every syringe. All planned.
Somebody did. And they updated every few years.
The 2024 version. I read about it. 10 basic modules, 1 supplementary. 48-hour shipping. It's a good system.
It's built on the essential medicines list. That's the connection Daniel was asking about.
The list is the plan. The kit is the execution. You need both.
The list without the kit is a document. The kit without the list is guesswork.
That's right.
The other thing the kit does is standardize emergency response. Before the kit existed, every aid agency packed its own supplies. Different medicines, different quantities, different quality. The kit created a common standard.
like the list did for national formularies. Same idea, different scale.
Standardization as a form of coordination.
It's the unglamorous part of global health. Nobody gets excited about procurement standards, but that's where the lives are saved or lost.
The medicines that don't arrive are the ones that kill people. Not the ones that are prescribed wrongly, but the ones that aren't there at all.
In Rotterdam, we had everything. That was the problem, too much of everything. In the places that actually need the medicines, the problem is the opposite.
The list is an attempt to fix both problems. It says no to the excess and yes to the essentials.
It's been saying that for 50 years, longer than I worked in that warehouse.
Since 1977.
I started at the warehouse in 1986. The list was already 9 years old. We didn't use it. Rotterdam didn't need it. But the medicines we shipped to Africa, those were based on the list. The NGOs buying from us used it as their guide.
Even in the excess, the list was shaping what went where.
That's the thing. The list is like the electrical grid. You don't notice it until the power goes out. But it's there, underneath everything.
When the power goes out, you're very glad someone built the grid.
The grid is old now, 50 years. But it still works. That's what I think about when I read about the new updates. The GLP-1 drugs, the cancer drugs. The list is still doing its job, still making the hard calls.
Still deciding what matters.
Still deciding what matters. That's the whole thing.
The cutting room floor detail I keep thinking about is that the 1977 committee met for 5 days and produced a 36-page report that sold out in 3 months, a technical document that became a bestseller. That tells you something about the appetite for clarity in a confusing world.
The appetite hasn't gone away. The list still gets attention every time it's updated because people want to know what made the cut and what didn't.
The question that stays with me is whether the list can keep up with the pace of pharmaceutical innovation. The 2025 update added 20 medicines, but there are thousands in development. The committee's selectivity is its strength, but it's also a constraint. At some point, the gap between what the list covers and what medicine can do becomes too wide.
That's the real challenge for the next 50 years. Not whether the list exists, but whether it can adapt fast enough to remain relevant.
Whether the access gap can be closed. 2 billion people is a lot of people to leave behind.
The list is the map. The journey is still ahead.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing.
This has been My Weird Prompts, the Human AI Collaboration Podcast.
If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro. With text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.